One of the most evocative pieces of writing that there is concerning the events surrounding the first Christmas is T.S. Eliot's The Journey of the Magi. It's a poem many of us will be familiar with. Some of us were made to learn it in school, and some of us were introduced to it later in life. It tells the story very simply and straightforwardly from the point of view of the wise men who were making their way to Jerusalem and then to Bethlehem. Simple, straightforward, matter-of-fact description of the story. But at the same time, it's full of imagery that demands the reader give it much thought concerning what it might mean. And so there's a lovely line about a third to a halfway through the poem when the writer remarks, "And three trees on the low sky." Three trees on the low sky. It may well have been just that. But Eliot is inviting us to draw the comparison between three trees on the low sky and three crosses on a hill. Indeed, what may have looked like trees from a distance may well have been crosses. The countryside in and around the area in which the wise men were traveling would have been full of crosses. The occupying power that were the Romans, they used crucifixion randomly and routinely, both to punish and to deter. So it's quite likely that even if these three trees weren't crosses, these wise men would have traveled through the countryside and would have come across crosses with people hanging on them, a little like we used to do in the Middle Ages when we used to hang people on crossroads to draw people's attention to their crimes and deter others from repeating it. No doubt as the Magi made their way to Bethlehem, they would have seen many crosses and they would all have been empty. The poet wants us to understand that the Jesus whom they were to visit, to make sense of his birth, it had to be set within the wider context of his life and his death. And what was true then has to be true for us now. We do not understand the incarnation if we regard Christmas as an event in itself, self-contained, all wrapped up in its distinctive wrapping paper. It's very easy to do that, to make Christmas a thing of itself, to divorce it from anything else. This is one time in the year when we're able to do X, Y, and Z, and Christmas gives us permission to do it. No, Christmas, if it means anything at all, has to extend its meaning beyond the event in itself, to take in not just a birth, but life and death as well. And in the latter part of the poem, the writer makes it personal. The wise men had been. They'd come, they'd seen the baby, and they'd wondered what it was all about. And then they had to go home. And as they were journeying home, Eliot puts these thoughts into the minds of one of those wise men. Were we led all that way for birth or death? There was a birth, certainly. We had evidence and no doubt they had seen the baby. I had seen birth and death, but had thought they were different. But this birth was hard and bitter agony for us, like death, our death. We return to our places, these kingdoms, but no longer at ease here in the old dispensation, with an alien people clutching their gods. I should be glad of another death. When we share communion at the heart of Christmas, it provides us with a perfect way to ensure that we don't lose sight of the whole story. More than to realize that the very fact that was Jesus being born into the world, it thereby sets in motion a sequence of events that will culminate in the cross. That lovely song we sang, Mary's Child, go to your cross of wood. This was bound to upset an otherwise ordered world and to disturb otherwise ordered lives and lifestyles. The birth of Jesus was going to turn the world upside down as much as it would turn individual lives upside down. Herod worked that out. Herod was a ruthless man, but he was sharp. He knew in his mind the consequences of what was happening in Bethlehem. When men come from countries afar looking for someone who was born King of the Jews, when Jewish teachers explained to him that this was promised over centuries ago, Herod begins to realize something's at work here, that if we don't contain in the moment, it will be lost to us forever. And so Herod, his response is one of savage butchery, beyond our imagining. Herod goes out and orders the slaughter of all the boy children under 1 year of age in a desperate attempt to end it before it had been. Matthew tells us that they went back to their own country another way, not just by a different route, but now to a different way of living, whether they liked it or not. To witness the birth of Jesus demanded of them that they put to death all that they otherwise held dear. That's the challenge of Christmas. If we really believe in what we say we see, if we really believe that what we see is God becoming human, dwelling amongst us, becoming one of us, and all of that, if all of that is what we see, then nothing can be the same again. We have to put to death that which we would otherwise hold dear for the sake of the one who has been born into our midst. The old dispensation was being displaced. They could no longer live at ease amongst it. Now what had previously been so familiar to them is now alien to their experience. The old gods confined to an idolatrous past. And for them, there was no future, hence their being glad of another death. It's an awful thought, isn't it? That the consequence of Christmas is that now there is no future for us. That God has so acted in the world, he so turned the world upside down, turned it on his head, turned our lives on its head to such an extent that we can no longer contemplate any sort of future. It would be better if we were all dead. And yet that was what the wise men were thinking. Life is now so difficult, so painful for us, it would be better if we were dead. But we know the story. And the story does not end with death. The crucifying effect of the incarnation is overwhelmed by resurrection power. The old dispensation heralds a new dispensation. And the kingdoms of this world become the kingdoms of our God and of his Christ. What we might call the clarion call of Advent. The old has passed away. Behold, the new has come. If there was nothing more to it than just putting a large full stop at the end of what is, then why would we bother? If all God was intending to do was call a halt to what had happened thus far, why? But no, God says we draw a line under what has been thus far in order that something new might be ushered in. But that of which we speak is but a foretaste of what is yet to be. And so we live in peculiar times, strange times. We live in a time where there is that tension that exists between the now and the not yet. What Paul describes in graphic terms in the letter to the Romans when he talks about the whole creation groaning within itself, wanting to yield up that which is within it, to give birth to a new creation. And yet for now, we are left with our travail, that which exists between the now and the not yet. We live in the now, yet all the while are blessed with a faith that dares us to believe in the not yet. You can only make sense of the here and now from the perspective of the not yet. That's the challenge of faith. It is no good living as if that which is not yet really is now. And some people do that. For then faith would be redundant and we would be left with nothing to live for other than an impending death. Advent confronts such a realization by daring us to believe that because the now is but a portent of the not yet, we do in fact have everything to live for. So the Christmas message, wrapped up as it is within the season of Advent, is a message of hope. Ultimate hope. The triumph of hope over adversity. The triumph of life over death. The victory of resurrection over crucifixion. Dietrich Bonhoeffer wrote, "I believe that God can and will bring good out of evil, even out of the greatest evil. For that purpose, he needs people who make the best use of everything. I believe that God will give us all the strength we need to help to resist in all times of distress. But he never gives it in advance, lest we should rely on ourselves and not on him alone. A faith such as this should allay all our fears for the future." We live in evil times. We are surrounded by evil, and no doubt we think at the worst of moments that we are about to be overwhelmed by it. And yet God dares us to believe that good can come from evil, and when the time comes, God will so work to bring that good from evil. But we have to wait for the time to come. And Jesus' birth is a foretaste of God bringing good from evil, the light shining in the darkness and the darkness not overcoming it. And yes, the light might burn as dimly as it has ever burned for now. The darkness may be as black as it's ever been for now, but the promise is that sooner or later, the light will blaze to such an extent that the darkness will be extinguished. But we have to be prepared to live patiently in the now while we wait for the not yet. And so we celebrate communion at Christmas to remind ourselves that whilst there is that of God which is not yet, that of God which we are yet to experience, that of God which is yet to be revealed to us, shared with us, received by us, yet God in Christ is really present with us in the now. A real presence that is represented for us in bread and wine, yes, but only represented because that real presence is far more profound than just a mere transubstantiating of the element. The real presence in the communion, there's more to it than that. So how does God confront us in Christ in the midst of the now? What is the challenge he lays at our door? What does he ask us to respond to? Bonhoeffer again. In total reality, God comes to us in the form of a beggar, of the dissolute human child in ragged clothes asking for help. He confronts us in every person we meet. As long as they are people, Christ will walk the earth as our neighbor, as the one through whom God calls us, speaks to us, makes demands on us. The Christian life is a demanding way of living. It is not an easy life. If you want an easy life, then following Jesus is not the life for you. If you want a fulfilling life, then following Jesus most assuredly is the life for you. Don't confuse ease of living with fulfilled life. So here we are, face to face with Jesus, God in the manger, demanding of us a response. And that response will depend very much on what we see when we see Jesus. We need to see ourselves reflected back to us. This is how we are. But more than that, to see ourselves as God sees us, to realize who we are in the light of God's presence. We need to see every man, every woman, anyone and everyone, and to realize that in God's loving the world in Jesus, God's giving of himself to the world in Jesus, if we are to be the people God would wish us to be, then we too have to give of ourselves in love to the world for the sake of Jesus alone. There was life before Bethlehem, and people went about doing their business. A small number of people were privileged to be invited to come to Bethlehem to see what had come to pass, amongst whom were those wise men. For them, because of their limited perspective on life, it was the very last thing they needed. But for us, privileged as we are to know that beyond death there is resurrection, it is the very best thing that we can do. So our invitation is to come and see what has come to pass and to share in it and to allow God to share in us his life.